The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in our second reading from the July 26, 2019 issue of the Week magazine. We'll start this show on the briefing page. The title is One Small Step for Man. 50 years ago this month, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first two human beings on the moon. Why did we go to the moon? On May 25, 1961, President John F. Kennedy told a joint session of Congress, "I believe this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth." Kennedy framed the goal as part of a battle that is now going on around the world between freedom and tyranny. In the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, the space race had become a proxy for which country's economic system was better, capitalism or communism. In all, Project Apollo would cost $25 billion, about $174 billion in today's dollars, employ 400,000 people at its peak, and involve the efforts of 20,000 firms and universities. Apollo was the biggest non-military effort in the history of human civilization, said journalist Charles Fishman, author of a book on the program. How did the project start? When NASA Administrator James E. Webb first asked Kennedy shortly after his inauguration in 1961 for enough money to pursue a moon landing, Kennedy told him no. But two events apparently changed Kennedy's mind. On April 12, 1961, Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space, and also the first to orbit the planet. By comparison, American Alan Shepard's flight on May 5th was brief and suborbital. 5 days later, after Gagarin's flight came back, the botched invasion of Cuba, known as the Bay of Pigs, a personal humiliation for JFK that raised fears that communism was winning both the space race and the Cold War. "I'm sure it, the Bay of Pigs, had an impact," said Jerome Wiesner, Kennedy's space science advisor. "I think the president felt some pressure to get something else in the foreground." What were the first steps? NASA quickly created a new mission control in Houston and a new launch facility on Merritt Island, Florida. Amid a frenzy of activity, a team of engineers led by former Nazi Wernher von Braun, who'd created the V-2 rockets that terrorized Britain during World War II, developed the Saturn series that would propel the craft. Meanwhile, the Russians launched their own lunar program, but it suffered a major setback when its chief rocket engineer, Sergei Korolev, died in 1966 during a botched surgery for hemorrhoids. So valuable was Korolev that the Soviets never publicly identified him by anything other than the title Glavny Konstruktor, chief designer, for fear the U.S. would assassinate him. "We had von Braun, and he built a rocket capable of a lunar landing mission," said John Logsdon, author of multiple books on the space race. "Without Korolev, the Soviet Union could not build an equally capable rocket." What was NASA's approach? Incremental, with each step advancing it closer to the goal. NASA conducted more than 20 crewed missions as part of the Project Apollo and its two predecessors, Project Mercury and Gemini. Apollo 8 flew to the moon, orbited, then returned. Apollo 9 linked up the command module and lander in Earth's orbit. Apollo 10 repeated the feat in lunar orbit, Finally, on July 16, 1969, Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Aldrin blasted off from Pad 39A at the Kennedy Space Center atop the Saturn V. They'd travel 240,000 miles over the next 76 hours and enter lunar orbit on July 19th. On the 20th, Armstrong began piloting the Eagle lander toward the lunar surface while Collins remained in orbit above. Collins later confessed he harbored a secret terror he'd be forced to leave his comrades behind. If they fail to rise from the surface or crash back into it, he wrote, I am not going to commit suicide. I am coming home, forthwith, but I will be a marked man for life, and I know it. In case of disaster, White House speechwriter William Safire wrote a contingency address for President Nixon. Fate, Safire wrote, has ordained that the men who went to the moon to explore in peace will stay on the moon to rest in peace. Nixon never had to say those words. Did the mission go smoothly? No. Amid a computer malfunction, Eagle overshot its landing area by several miles, forcing Armstrong to manually search for a smooth spot. Fuel ran short. His heart rate spiked to 156. Finally, at 4:17 p.m. EDT, the lander touched down. Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed, Armstrong said. Inside, he and Aldrin waited about 6.5 hours. At 10:39, Armstrong opened the hatch. A camera beamed the scene to some 600 million people back on Earth watching on live TV. At 10:56, he stepped foot on the surface and famously said, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." Aldrin followed 20 minutes later and described the lunar landscape as magnificent desolation. After Apollo 11, NASA made 5 more crewed landings on the moon over the next 3 years, but the final 3 planned Apollo missions were canceled due to budgetary restraints and lack of public interest. Going back to the moon. NASA intends to return to the moon, but the question is when. In March, Vice President Mike Pence announced the Trump administration had ordered NASA to return American astronauts to the moon within the next 5 years by any means necessary. But Project Artemis, as the new moon mission is known, faces major obstacles in meeting that deadline. NASA's new rocket, the Space Launch System, or SLS, is not scheduled for a test flight until 2020. Plans call for the construction of a platform in lunar orbit from which astronauts will descend to the surface, although much of the necessary technology does not yet exist. NASA must also build a new lunar lander and create new spacesuits. Oh, and the space agency must wrangle from Congress the additional $4 billion to $6 billion annually it'll need to accomplish the goal. A lot of things have to go right, said NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. We're back in the columns. We'll take one from Europe and one from Iran. So we start with Italy, a Russian scheme to fund populists. Can Italian Interior Minister Matteo Salvini weather the scandal surrounding possible Russian funding for his Nationalist League party, asked Alberto Magnani. Earlier this year, Italian media reported on rumored meeting between 3 Russians and 3 Italians close to Salvini at Moscow's Metropole Hotel last October. There, they discussed a scheme to have a Russian oil firm sell $1.5 billion worth of fuel to Italian energy giant Eni and divert some $65 million of the proceeds to the league. Last week, U.S. news site BuzzFeedNews.com published audio of the meeting and identified one of the Italians as Gianluca Savoni, a longtime close aide to Salvini. After the report, another Italian, international lawyer Gianluca Miranda, said he was also present. He denies any wrongdoing. Prosecutors in Milan said they'd been investigating the meeting for months, and this week they questioned Savoini. He also denies wrongdoing. So far, there is no proof that any money actually changed hands, and Salvini, who is also a deputy prime minister and governs the country in coalition with the populist Five-Star Movement, swears that Savoini is a rogue operative. "I have never taken a ruble, a euro, a dollar, or a liter of vodka of financing from Russia," he said. Salvini's fondness for Russian President Vladimir Putin is an open secret in Italy, said Dominic Straub in Der Standard. Before he entered government in 2018, the anti-immigrant Salvini praised Putin as a clear-headed leader who stands for an orderly, clean, and harmonious society. More recently, Salvini has called European Union sanctions on Russia for its 2014 annexation of Crimea idiotic, crazy, irresponsible, masochistic. Salvini has met with Putin frequently, mostly in Moscow, and usually in the company of Savoini, who has a Russian wife. At the European Parliament in 2014, Salvini wore a T-shirt that read, "No sanctions on Russia." "The League has always loved tyrants," said Gad Lerner in La Repubblica. Back when it was the Northern League, a secessionist party that wanted independence for Northern Italy, it supported Serbian despot Slobodan Milosevic. It saw Milosevic's oppression of Kosovar Muslims as heroic pushback against the usurpers of a Christian land that belonged to the Serbs. And it denounced NATO's 1999 bombing campaign against Serbia, a campaign that included the Italian armed forces. Then, as now, League members loved the Christian pan-Slavism preached by Moscow. Once Salvini took over the party in 2013, he signed a partnership pact with Putin's United Russia Party. "Salvini is going to try to brazen this out," said Monica Guerzoni in Corriere della Sera. "He claims he has nothing to say to the Italian parliament on the matter and acts as though Savoini, who functioned as his party's primary liaison with Russia, is little more than a ghost." It could work if Salvini succeeds in getting a tax cut passed, as he hopes. Italians may be so happy with the extra cash in their pockets that they'll lose interest in this scandal. Iran, can the unraveling nuclear deal be saved? "My country is beginning to lose its patience," said Hossein Mousavian, a former member of Iran's nuclear negotiating team. Iran scrupulously kept to the terms of the 2015 international deal brokered by the Obama administration, which severely limited Iranian nuclear programs in exchange for the easing of sanctions. Even after the Trump administration unilaterally pulled out of the pact in May 2018 and reimposed crippling sanctions, Iran gave the other signatories to the deal, Russia, China, the European Union, Germany, France, and the UK, a year to find a workaround. They didn't, and our economy has suffered horribly. Inflation is above 50%, and our oil exports have plummeted from 2.5 million barrels a day to only 300,000. Tehran cannot be expected to fully comply with a deal when others are failing to meet their obligations. That's why Iran last month exceeded the pact's 660-pound limit on its uranium stockpile and announced it will enrich uranium to about 5%, above the 3.7% limit allowed by the deal, but still well below the 90% needed for a nuclear weapon. Iran has been more than restrained. If President Trump wants to resolve this unnecessary, self-imposed crisis, he needs to make a swift strategic turnaround. Iran is no innocent party, said Gulf News in an editorial. It has been intent on disrupting international maritime trade and creating a crisis in the global oil and energy markets. British Marines recently seized an Iranian oil tanker in the Mediterranean as it attempted to violate international sanctions and deliver fuel to the Syrian regime. In retaliation, three Iranian gunboats tried to intercept a British tanker, a brazen act of piracy. They backed away when a British warship intervened. And in recent months, at least four tankers in the Arabian Gulf have been damaged by explosions that bore Iran's fingerprints. All this proves that Tehran has nothing but contempt for the rule of international law. Still, Europe is going all out to save the nuclear deal, said Rafael Ravais. European foreign ministers this week declared that while Iran had breached the deal by ramping up production of enriched uranium, its steps were reversible and not significant, so they declined to punish Iran. Europe is still trying to convince Iran that it can make up for the U.S. sanctions through INSTEX, a barter system that bypasses the American financial system. This could have long-term consequences for America, said Rami Khoury. Russia and China are determined to buy Iranian oil under the table if necessary. They are also exploring payment mechanisms that don't rely on U.S. dollars. If successful, that Beijing-Moscow venture will undermine the dollar's role as the global currency. This year could mark the beginning of the end for the unipolar U.S.-dominated world order that emerged at the end of the Cold War. Time for the last word, our in-depth article. The title this week is, quote, reality shows often aren't real. My husband and I had a great time touring houses for two episodes of House Hunters, said Elizabeth Newcamp in Slate.com. One thing you didn't see on air? We were already living in the great houses we found on TV. When people learn that my husband and I have been on House Hunters not just once but twice, they always have a million questions. Once we are done explaining, though, they never like my answers and wish they'd never asked. This is because even those smart viewers know that reality TV is created and edited just as carefully as scripted TV, they still, in the back of their minds, think that there must be some baseline rules about the reality that's portrayed. But there aren't. So I'm going to tell you all about my experience with House Hunters International, on which we appeared in 2017, and House Hunters, which we filmed last winter and appeared on in June. My story might burst your bubble about the show. If this is not something you want, stop reading now. The first thing you need to know is that in neither episode of House Hunters were Jeff and I actually house hunting. One time we'd already closed on the house we chose in the episode. The other time we'd already lived in our house for a year. House Hunters International is always looking for people who have moved abroad to feature on the show. I write a blog about our family and our travels, which made us perfect. We were already willing to share our lives publicly. We filled out an application, submitted some iPhone footage of each of us giving a house tour, and underwent a Skype interview with a casting director, focusing on how we might be in conflict while looking for a house. The interview also seemed meant to ensure we weren't a family of sloths or murderers, though maybe that would make better TV. Shortly after the interview, we found out we were cast, but then waited months with no further word. Jeff and I often wondered if we had been dropped. During this wait, I found out I was pregnant. Months later, in a whirlwind, we scheduled dates to film. A camera person, sound engineer, director, and fixer would be in our town of Delft in the Netherlands for 1 week in mid-July 2016 to shoot our episode. I was now 7 months pregnant. We would be paid a flat rate of $1,500 for our time. The 5 days of shooting were organized by location, availability, not in any sort of chronological order. One day we would film seeing the town of Delft for the first time, and the next day we were all moved into our house as though we had lived there for a few months. Keeping up with where we were in the story and what verb tense to use was a constant battle. In one of my favorite shots, we pretended to purchase a heavy Backfitz cargo bicycle for the first time, and I rode off over a bridge, pregnant, with the children nicely tucked in. In reality, my first terrifying ride had been a year before, crisscrossing the road to stay up and stalling halfway up the bridge. My first ride on TV, though, was effortless. Some things about the show are completely transparent. There is no wardrobe or makeup department. You'll hear plenty of opinions on what you should wear, but everything is coming out of your own closet. I learned that all my favorite tops have stripes on them, a no-no for the camera. But I was surprised how even the littlest details could be fictionalized. When they couldn't find a local real estate agent, the House Hunters International producers needed a Dutch person who was willing to be on camera for $500 as our relocation expert. Our neighbor and friend Michael, who actually works in IT, was happy to oblige. In the episode, I hinted at the absurdity of the whole situation when Michael mentioned that he lived near a house we were looking at. "Oh, so we could be neighbors," I exclaimed, while biking to tour our actual house, down the street from his, where my children were playing with his daughter, under the supervision of his wife. In conversation with the production crew, you outline your storyline before you start shooting. We learned immediately that these shows are looking for conflict, so it's important to be ready to fight a little with your spouse. We actually really thought this was fun. Throwing a few punches in a safe space on things that don't matter can be really cathartic. The entire point of the show is to make it seem impossible that you will ever find a house. The show is intended to resemble a real-life house hunt, but exaggerated for TV. So you take your real-world wants, and in each house you visit, you hand that up. In House Hunters International, I mentioned that I wanted a bathtub, something that is nearly impossible to find in the Netherlands. At the producer's urging, I soon became all about the bathtub. I hopped into available tubs to try them out and lamented through the entire house tours about how I would live with three kids, no less, without a bathtub. I was pregnant, after all, and that tub was a necessity. In reality, a bathtub was on my wish list, but not something that would have made me pass on a great house. If we were looking for a house, which we weren't, because we had one, with a bathtub. The houses we toured for the show were not for sale. Our small city of Delft had very little housing turnover. As a result, we visited two properties that were listed for rent on Airbnb. They did, to be fair, reflect the types of homes and features you would find in Delft. When it came time to film us touring our home, the production company had a problem. It needed to make the house look like we didn't live there yet. So it hired a moving company to essentially move us out of our own house. We woke up early one morning and watched all our belongings from any room that would be filmed for the show get loaded into a moving truck. The truck was then driven around for a few hours while we shot the segments in which we toured the house. I borrowed bedspreads from friends to make the bedrooms look different. A trunk at the end of my master bed, engraved with my college insignia, remained. An Easter egg to my close friend that was, in fact, our house. In several of the outtakes, I mistakenly opened a closet, only to remember it was full of my clothing. Our fridge was packed full. It, too, could not be opened during filming. The playset in the backyard was too big to move, so the camera person stood in front of it and shot us in a different part of the yard, speculating about how much our kids would love playing on the lawn. That afternoon, the moving truck returned and put our house back together. Meanwhile, we changed clothes, moved over to the playset, and played with our children while the camera person filmed the after shots. At each house you film, the throw your partner under the bus interview. This is where you act like your partner is crazy pants. Again, a good sense of humor is key here. Everything I said in my interviews was based on a grain of truth, but in a real house hunting situation, I would never phrase it that way. In one particular interview, after Jeff saw how much he loves a rooftop garden, I lamented that our children would run right off, plummeting into the canal he loves so dearly. Jeff and I would listen in on each other's interviews, but not stand where we could see each other. This helped us recognize how the other was going to be portrayed and to learn and to lean into it all. After a wild week of shooting houses and touring locations around the city accompanied by a camera crew, we returned to our normal lives. 8 months later, our episode ran. I watched it with a new baby on my lap, then logged on to Twitter to see what people were saying. In our House Hunters International episode, Jeff is portrayed as wanting a small house that is close to work no matter what. People on Twitter ate him alive for not letting his pregnant wife have the house she wanted. So after that insanity, you might be wondering why in the world we would decide to do all this again by signing on to House Hunters. It is obviously not the money. The U.S. House Hunters show only pays $500, or fame, although I was once recognized by a lovely American couple in an airport in Budapest as the crazy bathtub lady. But Jeff and I can't resist doing interesting things. We loved getting a little peek at the world of entertainment. Plus, we walked away with a video snapshot of this one moment of our lives. So when we moved back to the United States, we got in contact with House Hunters Production Company, which is different from House Hunters International Production Company. We applied again, which was a bit of a shorter process since the company could watch our previous episode to prove we weren't sloths or murderers. We had another Skype interview, although this time Jeff was already in Florida looking for houses, and I was at my parents' house in Atlanta. They told us to let them know when we were under contract on a house. Finding a house in Florida turned out to be a nightmare. Jeff looked at nearly 60 properties, and Hurricane Michael hit during the search. We found a house after the evacuation order was lifted. We signed papers and got the keys to our new home on Friday. That Monday, the film crew filmed us touring our brand new empty house. We also shot some footage of the family at our hotel on Navarre Beach, pretending we had been living there through the extensive house search. Then the production crew left us for 2 weeks. After we moved in, they came back to film us again. The houses we saw in Florida were actually for sale. Our actual realtor is on the show, unpaid, and helped line up two other houses for us to look at. They just weren't the houses we actually saw during our house hunt. The second time around, filming was a bit harder. Our chemistry with the director was completely different. Instead of feeling relaxed and fun, everything was more businesslike. We were coached to sit in particular ways that were not natural for us. Jeff and I like to sit up very straight, and we sit close together, which apparently looks bad on TV. Discussion in the houses was more mechanical and less silly. Jeff and I naturally live in the silly. Our camera guy was fastidious about shots. We had to hit marks in the house to get different angles of basically the same conversation. At one point, Jeff was so tired of doing this that he went into autopilot and recited everyone else's lines. I think he was getting hangry. The Florida episode, which aired last month, turns on Jeff not being satisfied with any house and all the little home repair problems he finds when house hunting. While this is a real thing, He took it to the extreme. Meanwhile, I begged him just to find a house, any house. I played up becoming obsessed with finding a house with indoor and outdoor play space, something I likely say 1,000 times in the episode, to set our hooligans free. Again, these reflect real discussions we had, but conducted in extremes for the benefit of the show. Here is the thing. You should absolutely enjoy house hunters. I still do. Don't worry about how these people with these jobs afford these houses. Enjoy the real estate and enjoy the fake arguments. But like everything you see on TV, you shouldn't take it at face value. I do, however, love a good bathtub. This article originally appeared on Slate.com. We'll read a couple of the business columns this week, starting with the Fed got bullied by Trump. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell's suddenly dovish turn is a rookie mistake, said Rex Nutting. Recall that 3 weeks ago, Fed officials concluded at their June meeting that no rate cuts were necessary, and the economic outlook has only brightened since then. We're fresh off a robust month for hiring, capital and consumer spending, and a rebound in trade flows. So naturally, the Fed is planning to cut interest rates later in July as insurance against the possibility, however remote, that the economy might soon collapse because of slowing global growth. The real reason for the change, Powell has been bullied by President Trump, who keeps barraging him with tweets and the financial markets into injecting more liquidity. This repeats the mistakes that fed the disastrous NASDAQ bubble 2 decades ago. If trade wars are the primary cause of uncertainty, the only solution is to resolve that uncertainty. That's Trump's job. It's not Powell's responsibility to paper over it with cheap money. Or, if lack of confidence is the issue, it does no good to see the Federal Reserve in full panic mode. So how exactly does a rate cut help? The Fed should be taking away the punch bowl so that the party doesn't get out of hand. Instead, Powell is letting the stock market inflate and declaring happy hour at the saloon. There's no replacement for the Beetle. Volkswagen's decision to kill its iconic Beetle is all the more painful because of what's replacing it, said Chris Bryant. That's right, another compact sports utility vehicle. Is that going to capture hearts the way the Love Bug did? Doubtful. But small, inexpensive cars are rapidly becoming an endangered species in Western markets. Consumers want SUVs, and car makers have been happy to oblige. In the U.S., big cars and trucks account for 70% of the new vehicle market, as cheap credit and low gas prices make the larger cars more affordable. In Europe, small cars still make up about a third of the market, but in a somewhat perverse twist, they are actually threatened by tougher emissions standards. The high cost of electrification technology is difficult to combine with the economics of smaller, cheaper cars. Installing an emissions-cutting kit in a compact car requires either a prohibitively high sticker price or the sacrifice of profit margins. And unless battery prices fall, several entry-level models might be facing the chop. All this means that there will be fewer new vehicles available for poorer or younger customers, many of whom have already switched to car sharing, bike sharing, and e-scooters. SUVs have killed the small, affordable vehicle, but their future is not assured either. And here's a Making Money article about the minimum wage. Employment, the $15 minimum wage gathers steam. A Congressional Budget Office analysis released last week makes clear that the benefit of a $15 an hour minimum wage would heavily outweigh the downside, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. The agency found that as many as 1.3 million people could be lifted out of poverty if the federal minimum wage rose from $7.25 in stages over 5 years, boosting the wages of 27 million Americans. The CBO said the change might also lead to the loss of 1.3 million jobs. Opponents have seized on that point, but the agency acknowledges it is manifestly more uncertain than most of the rest of the analysis. The uncertainty sounds familiar, said Noah Smith in Bloomberg.com. Many CBO studies rely on sifting through a large and often contradictory body of research. The most recent studies, however, tend to find very small job losses from raising pay floors. In many places and industries, companies hold wages below what a competitive market would offer. A higher minimum could just restore the competitive balance between workers and employers. Tell that to the small businesses that are particularly vulnerable to cost increases, said Tiana Lowe in the Washington Examiner. Big businesses, meanwhile, will simply automate the jobs. Just go to your local McDonald's and order from the kiosk to see this in action. Some companies and places that have raised the minimum wage are already blaming wage laws for driving them out of business, said Jeremy Hill in Bloomberg.com. Restaurants Unlimited, a West Coast chain of 35 fine dining and casual eateries, filed for bankruptcy protection last week. It said progressive wage laws in Seattle, San Francisco, and Portland had inflated wage expenses by a total of $10.6 million, more than the mid-sized chain, with a total revenue of $176 million in a year, could afford. Don't base your opinion on one example, said economist Anna Gadoui in Michael Reich in CNN.com. We've done the research on 51 minimum wage increases in 45 states and found that higher minimum wages do not have adverse effects on employment. We also found that in low-wage areas where the highest proportion of workers received pay increases, there were wage increases across the board. That matches other research that wage increases ripple upward, said Andrew Van Dam in the Washington Post. As much as 40% of wage benefits go to workers who aren't directly affected by the law. And there are other surprising benefits. Raising the minimum wage by 10% could reduce suicides by 3.6% among adults with a high school degree. Another bonus, higher minimum wages have even been shown to cut crime by making ex-convicts less likely to return to their old ways. We'll circle back to the health and science page and also pick up a couple of technology articles this week, starting with, could planting trees halt climate change? Scientists have calculated that cheapest and most effective way to fight climate change may be to plant trees, a trillion of them. Because trees soak up atmospheric carbon dioxide, a major contributor to global warming, researchers from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology decided to examine what would happen if saplings were replanted on lands where forests had been cleared. They concluded that the planet could support an extra 2.2 billion acres of tree cover, an area almost the size of the U.S. Those new forests, the researchers say, would remove about two-thirds of the roughly 330 billion tons of carbon pumped into the atmosphere by humans since the Industrial Revolution. Reforestation is the top climate change solution in terms of carbon storage potential, co-author Thomas Crowder tells Vox.com. Crowder and his colleagues identified six countries where the majority of the reforestation would need to take place: Russia, the U.S., Canada, Australia, Brazil, and China. And they say trees need to be planted sooner rather than later because climate change could soon make it impossible for forests to thrive in some areas, such as the tropics. Other climate scientists say the global reforestation plan is too ambitious to be realistic, and that governments should focus on reducing carbon emissions, not coming up with ways to scrub greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. Supplements and heart health. Millions of people who take dietary supplements to protect their heart are likely getting no health benefits, and in some cases might be harming themselves. That's the conclusion of a new meta-analysis of 277 studies, which together included nearly 1 million people to determine supplements' effects on cardiovascular health. The researchers found that only a few of the 16 supplements and 8 diets tested appeared to do any good. Omega-3 fatty acids, commonly found in fish oil, appeared to lower the risk of heart attacks and coronary heart disease. Folic acid was linked to a reduced risk of stroke. But the evidence for those benefits wasn't particularly strong. Vitamin A, B, C, D, and E supplements didn't appear to help heart health at all, nor did calcium, iron, or multivitamins. Furthermore, researchers found taking calcium with vitamin D increases the risk of stroke, possibly because it increases blood clotting and hardens arteries. People who are taking these supplements for the sake of improving their cardiovascular health are wasting their money, said lead author Safi Khan from West Virginia University, tells the New York Times. And this on the technology page, innovation of the week. The molecular structure of the mother of pearl inside an oyster shell showed scientists how to create glass that is virtually shatterproof, said Roni Dingler in Discover. The bio-inspired glass designed by engineers at McGill University is 2 to 3 times more impact-resistant than tempered or even bulletproof laminated glass. That's because they designed it around the microscopic structure of mother-of-pearl, whose tiny mineral building blocks slide apart under force, allowing the material to take on substantial blows without breaking. The new glass is transparent, does not produce any image distortions, and when scientists did use enough force to damage it, it dented instead of cracking. The material could be used for everything from windows and windshields to solar panels and touch screens. A new meaning for the, quote, home office. Confronted with relentless busyness, some modern households are starting to run more like offices, said Taylor Lorentz and Joe Pinkster in The Atlantic, and they're co-opting office software to help. One mom of 4 in Illinois set up an account with Trello, a web-based project management tool, to keep up with chores, to-do lists, shopping, and homework. Such productivity tools might be useful in the increasing number of households with 2 working parents, where they can help coordinate who's in charge of what areas of the domestic domain. But they can be taken too far. One dad set up a home Slack account with custom-built little tools within the program that would let members of his family add items to the grocery list, among other tasks. After a few months, though, the kids gravitated toward apps that were more fun. Coaches for the Screen Time Wars. A new screen-free parenting coach economy has sprung up to serve parents trying to curb their kids' screen addiction, said Nellie Bowles in the New York Times. In Seattle, Gloria DiGaetano launched the Parent Coaching Institute, a network of 500 coaches charging up to $250 an hour to offer various remedies. Some are absurdly basic, like getting kids to be around more kids who are playing on jungle gyms or jumping rope. Another increasingly popular prescription is for groups of parents to band together to make public promises to withhold smartphones from their children until eighth grade. Other coaches are advocating for whole lifestyle changes. I tell a lot of parents to get a dog, says one. Google's in-camera interpreter. Google Translate updated its instant camera feature, and the results are amazing, said Stacy Lesea in Travel Plus Leisure. For those unfamiliar with the service, you can start by downloading the Google Translate app. Then simply point your phone camera at foreign text and voila, it will be instantly translated into English. This makes ordering off a foreign menu or scrutinizing a sign for directions while traveling abroad much easier. Google recently increased its supported languages to more than 100. So instead of just being able to translate French or Arabic into English, travelers can now translate Belarusian into Igbo or Irish into Persian. A new auto-detect feature will automatically detect the language captured in the camera, which helps when traveling in a region with multiple languages. We don't often get to the people page, so we'll share a couple of those today. Crosby's confrontation with death. At 77, David Crosby is releasing music at a feverish pace, said Alan Paul in the Wall Street Journal. A Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee as a member of the Byrds and Crosby, Stills and Nash, Crosby has released 4 solo albums in the past 5 years. "Because I'm going to die," he explains. "I have 8 stents in my heart. I'm going to have a heart attack in the next year or two, and that'll be it. I'm trying to get the music out of my head first." His legendary career was derailed after the 1969 death of his girlfriend, Christine Hinton, in a car accident. "To dull the pain, I loved her," he says. Crosby became a heroin addict. He'd nod off on stage and did an 8-month stint in prison in 1985. His years of drug use led to a major falling out with Graham Nash, Stephen Stills, and Neil Young, and he no longer speaks with them. "Me becoming a junkie was the worst thing I did to my partners," he says. "I so wish I had avoided that, but there's no point in being dishonest about having made a terrible mistake." Crosby speaks matter-of-factly about death as he faces not only heart disease, but also hepatitis C, diabetes, and the effects of a liver transplant. "No matter how long you live," he says, "the question is the same. What are you going to do with it? I want to make the world better, and the only thing I can contribute is music." A-Rod's amazing revival. "Alex Rodriguez had a long fall from grace," said Ben Ryder in Sports Illustrated. "Once one of the best players in baseball history, the 14-time All-Star came to be seen as an overpaid pretty boy. And after his season-long ban in 2014 for using performance-enhancing drugs, everyone thought he was finished. A-Rod among them. Crying as he watched that season's opening day on TV, I was broken, dead, tapping out, thinking crazy things," he said. He got 2 more seasons with the New York Yankees, but with his skills severely diminished, he retired. Since then, he's pulled off an astonishing image revival, casting aside a stilted public persona he called the robot. "I had it backwards," said Rodriguez. "I tried to say the right things, to be manipulative, instead of doing the right things." Now he works 80-hour weeks at his investment company, A-Rod Corp., which has hundreds of millions in assets. An insightful color commentator on ESPN, he's also a red carpet fixture with Jennifer Lopez, who wears his $1.8 million engagement ring. "I fell from the Empire State Building," Rodriguez says. "Nobody pushed me. I jumped. But what's changed is I got my backside humbled. I paid a deep penalty. I've learned lessons, and I'm different." And we'll go on to the Talking Points page, and pick up with an article, Obamacare, another GOP attempt to kill it. The Affordable Care Act and health insurance for tens of millions of people are suddenly in jeopardy again, said Jonathan Cohn in HuffingtonPost.com. After the Supreme Court seemed to settle the constitutionality of the ACA, commonly known as Obamacare, in 2012, the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has again taken up the question. Last week, the Trump administration backed a lawsuit brought by GOP officials in 20 states, got a credulous, sympathetic-sounding hearing from two Republican-appointed judges during oral arguments. That's hard to fathom. The lawsuit claims the whole ACA is now void after the Republican-controlled Congress eliminated the penalty on the uninsured in 2017. In ruling the law constitutional, the Supreme Court had said the penalty functioned as a tax, which was within Congress's powers. Now, in an argument that most legal experts call positively bonkers, Republican states insist that without a tax penalty, all Obamacare should fall. Winning this lawsuit would be a disaster for Republicans, said Ramesh Ponuru in Bloomberg.com. As many as 30 million people might lose their health insurance, and insurers could once again discriminate against people with chronic conditions. State budgets would be devastated without federal reimbursement for Medicaid expansion, which would likely force some states to abandon at least some of the 13 million who got coverage that way. The 2020 electoral backlash against the GOP could be massive, and it's not as if Republicans have advanced any plan for a post-ACA healthcare system. Yes, but political expediency should not be the determining factor here, said Aaron Hawley in TheFederalist.com. This lawsuit is about limiting the power of the federal government to force people to do something. In this case, buy health insurance. That's a fight that's worth fighting. That fight is based on a legal argument that is clearly specious, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Lawyers for the Republican states claim that if Congress had made the penalty $1 instead of eliminating it, then the ACA would still be constitutional. I'm not a lawyer, but if a legal argument has absurd implications, it's an absurd argument. Let's hope that the Fifth Circuit agrees, and if it doesn't, that John Roberts' Supreme Court rides to the rescue of the ACA again. Otherwise, health care protections that are now part of the fabric of American life will be destroyed. The census, a retreat on citizenship question. America's swaggering, bar-fighting, picking president has finally surrendered, said the New York Daily News in an editorial. After months of lies and evasions, President Trump admitted he doesn't have a kosher reason for forcing a citizenship question onto the 2020 U.S. Census forms. Spinning his retreat as a victory, he promised to issue an executive order for federal agencies to compile a tally of citizens and non-citizens from existing databases. We should all be relieved. After the Supreme Court ruled that the administration could not include the question because it had lied about its real motivation to reduce the number of Hispanics participating, Trump was left with only two options: go rogue or back down. It's fortunate for our constitutional democracy that he backed down. Actually, Trump's capitulation was a defeat for our democracy, said Henry Olson in the Washington Post. There are now 22 million to 25 million non-citizens living in the U.S. Counting them in data used to redraw districts means some citizen votes will count more than others, in many cases by a lot more. The total population in House districts averages 747,000, but in certain California districts with lots of non-citizens and children, there are as few as 346,000 citizens. This gives the vote of people in those heavily Democratic districts more weight than in high citizen districts. That's simply not fair. Democrats now reject the whole concept of citizenship, said Jonathan Tobin in the New York Post. They have adopted a transnationalist open borders ideology that seeks to absolve illegal immigrants of any crime and grant them equal status with driver's licenses and taxpayer-funded health care. Viewed in that context, Trump's loss over the citizenship question was also a defeat for U.S. sovereignty and the rule of law. For progressive, Trump's retreat on the central question is not a victory, said Elsie Mistel in TheNation.com. It's a warning. From the moment the Supreme Court ruled, Trump angrily threatened to defy it, seeing how the country and cowed Republicans would react. Trump walked the country up to the edge of a full-blown constitutional crisis, treating the rule of law like a suggestion that Chief Justice John Roberts left in his inbox. What happens next time a high court ruling doesn't go Trump's way? I am reminded of King Pyrrhus of Epirus, who once said, "One other victory, and we shall be utterly ruined." We have time for a short note or two. We'll start with over 30 months, about two-thirds of President Trump's top aides have left his administration, many amid scandals or conflicts with Trump, a rate far higher than for previous presidents. Trump has had six communications directors, three chiefs of staff, three national security advisors, four secretaries of Homeland Security, and he currently has nine acting directors running cabinet departments or major agencies. The U.S. government estimates that police departments in the U.S. have warehoused more than 200,000 untested sexual assault kits, although some estimates are far higher. And we'll finish with a quote from Elbert Hubbard, who says, "No man needs a vacation so much as the man who has just had one." Well, we'll think about that as we've run out of time for today's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.